Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Hake. And as the leaves turn, our taste turns to sweets. Gimme, gimme, gimme.
Yes. Even your taste is turning to sweets, huh? there must be some pretty special stuff that's been crossing our studio recently.
Oh, yeah.
All about cookies and chocolate and pie and...
I mean, my favorite baker is Dory Greenspan, and she's had this passion for cookies for a long time. She did cookie pop-ups and whatever. Anyhow, she finally wrote a book about it, and it's a magnificent book.
And they're all new recipes.
And they are.
Absolutely amazing.
And it's called it's not cookies, it's called Dory's Cookies. All you cookie lovers out there, there is one book and only one book that you'll ever need from henceforth. It's Dory Greenspan's Dory's Cookies. Congratulations, Dory, on a magnificent, absolutely magnificent book.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad you like it.
Well, why not to like it? Now, you worked long and hard on this. You've been thinking about cookies for a long time. You did that pop-up. Could you talk about that with your son?
Sure. So I have loved cookies all my life. And our son, Joshua, had this idea that because I baked cookies and he loved what I baked, that we should go into business. Now, you know, I'm old enough to know better than to just listen to that. But he was my son, still is my son, and I loved him so much. I said, sure. And so that's how we went into business. And we did about three or four wildly exhausting and wildly successful cookie pop-ups. And then, in fact, we opened a cookie boutique that was called Burr & Sell.
Yes. And you have those recipes in this book, the Burr & Sell
collection. Well, yes, because we closed the bakery, and people kept saying, oh, but we love your cookies, and will you go back into business? And I said, nope, never going back into business. But I promise one day I'll put all of those recipes in a book, and they're all in Dory's Cookies.
Well,
yes.
And so many others, too. I mean, how many cookie recipes do you have in here?
So there are 170 recipes.
Wow.
When I was talking to my editor, we were trying to figure out how many cookie recipes I had created or published, and it's more than 300. But when it came to writing an all cookie cookbook, I wanted to create all new cookies. So this is not a best of. This has got about five best of recipes because there were some that I couldn't bear to not have in the book.
Oh, right.
But these were all, this was new thinking about cookies.
Now, that's a direct lead-in to the thing that fascinates me the most. Let me first of all say that anybody who wants to use this book can be reassured that you test and test and test your recipes. It's the one book, that any book you write is the book that I will trust because I know
how tested the recipes are.
And all the recipes work. But what I was going to lead into is I was fascinated with the idea that you actually came up with recipes with dreams in your sleep.
And it's true.
How does that happen, Dory?
But, you know, so I dream about food all the time because I think about food all the time. And when I was working on this book, I worked on this book for about 3 years. And so for 3 years, it was cookies, 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 cookies. And it was literally cookies day and night. And my most successful dream occurred in Paris, where so many wonderful things happen. But I dreamed about a cookie that later became the Jammer.
Oh, yes.
And it's a cookie that's, the base of it is a shortbread cookie, my French sablé, French for, you know, a shortbread. Right. So it's a vanilla shortbread cookie. It has a dollop of jam in the center, and then it has streusel all around the jam. So it looks like, you know, it looks like a jam tart, really. And so it's thicker than your usual cookie, and it has that wonderful shortbread underneath and the crunch of the streusel. It's one of my all-time favorite cookies. And so I had a dream about it. I jumped up, woke my husband, said, "Jammer." And he said, "Yes," you know, kind of like, "Yes, dear, yes, dear." And the following morning, I even knew the name. Everything happened in that dream. And the following morning, I made it. And I was in Paris, and I brought it to Pierre Hermé, who is probably, you know, the best pastry chef in the world. But actually, he was just named best pastry chef in the world. He's a friend of mine and someone I've worked with. And I said, "I'm sorry to disturb you, but I have something you have to taste. Taste my dream." And he declared it perfect, so I knew that that was a sweet dream. That was great. Not all of the cookies happen that easily.
Oh, but, I mean, you have so many ingenious... Let's talk about the structure of this book. People reviewing your books always say that it's sort of like having you standing at their elbow next to them in the kitchen, telling them what to do.
And, I love that, by the way.
Yeah, well, it's over and over again. I mean, it's not just me or a couple other people. Everybody seems to say that.
I think about when I'm writing recipes, I actually imagine myself in the kitchen with a cook or a baker helping them get through the recipe. So I love that that comes across in the page.
Oh, it sure does. And, I mean, you have, like, bits of information about things I didn't even know to ask questions about. Even, you know, in the usual run-up, like equipment and techniques and so forth, it's very thorough, Dori.
Well, I really wanted it to be. I've wanted to write a cookbook, I think, forever. But I'm not writing a second one. This is it. There's no follow-up. And so I wanted to put everything that I loved in the book. And I also, and I feel this way about all of the work that I do, and I'm sure all authors do. When you're writing a cookbook, what you really want is for the home cook, the home baker, to be successful with the recipes. That's all you want. You want to give the reader something that you love and have the reader and the baker, the cook, love it as much because they're successful making it. And so I try to cram in as much information as possible.
Well, you do. You do techniques. You do ingredients. You do gear.
I thought it was important to do that for this book. Cookies are super easy, and for many of us, those are the first things that we bake. You can always polish your skills, and so I wanted to have that extra information in the book.
Well, now, how to pick... And I want to interject here that people picking up this book, even if you had no intention of baking cookies, the photographs and the styling will be enough to get you in the kitchen with your gear and your ingredients and your techniques.
Oh, I hope so. I hope so. I'm a baking evangelist. I want everyone in their kitchen baking cookies.
Yeah, well, you like shortbread, which I absolutely love.
Yeah, I wanted to make an observation about that on the way through, because shortbread in my mind always has Walkers on the label, and the packages are tartan, which is mostly red, and we actually met the family member who was presently in charge of this company at the fancy food show wasn't it, sweetheart?
I think so.
He was there at the fancy food show talking about his cookies himself.
I like that. I actually love Walker's shortbread.
Yeah, I mean, it's so terrific. And the interesting thing is, he said they've been making them for all this time in the original factory, and they just built a new factory in the same town.
Yes.
So everybody will still keep their jobs, which is nice.
Exactly. More than two times as many people will have jobs. I thought that was really interesting.
And maybe even twice as many cookies in the world. But, you know, the thing about shortbread is, aside from the fact that it's delicious and has that wonderful kind of it's both melt in your mouth and just a little sandy, which I really love as a texture. It's a great base to play around with so that it accepts other flavors. I mean, I love vanilla shortbread, but it could be lavender. It could have chopped chocolate in it. There are chocolate shortbreads. There's shortbread with espresso in it. It's really, once, if you love shortbread, once you make it, your mind can just wander and you can have an entire wardrobe of shortbread cookies.
I actually found myself reading the stories of the cookies.
Good. I wrote them for you to read, Peter.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's like just a matter of fueling yourself so that you're in the middle of the night, you'll dream about a new cookie recipe. But I thought the Anzac recipe, for example, you explain that it ought to have this, that, and the other ingredient in it, but it doesn't, because back in 1915, when the Anzacs first went to war, there was a shortage of the kinds of ingredients they might have liked to put in. And you have these kinds of little insights. And
I was fascinated by that.
We lived in Australia, and anytime anybody mentions an Australian dessert, I think of pavlova and Anzac cookies.
Well, and I have another dessert from Australia.
Which is
because
that?
I have a friend, Natasha, who I was talking to her on the phone. Let me see where it is.
It's not a Lamington, is it?
I always hated
Lamingtons.
Well, good. Unless this cookie goes by another name, it's not a Lamington. So I was talking to Natasha, and she said that her mother made something that she called fruit and walnut bread bars.
Huh?
And I had never seen a recipe like this before. It has nothing to do with bread. So it has dried fruit in it, and she said that her mother always used red and green cherries, ginger, and pineapple.
Wow.
I couldn't bring myself to use the cherries, the green cherries.
With the plastic, you mean?
Well, I just couldn't. But so dried fruit, flour, baking powder, egg whites, salt, sugar, and walnuts. So there's no butter in the recipe.
Amazing.
Right? And there are no egg yolks. It's just the white. There's no oil. And it bakes to, you cut them into strips so that they're almost like biscotti, but they're the opposite of biscotti in texture. They're chewy. They're beautiful. They're jam-packed with fruit and nut. And I was so surprised by this recipe. Things like this, I get really excited about this. So this was, Natasha said that this was a traditional recipe from her Australian family. I was so happy to get it.
Oh,
and it was such
great.
A surprise when I made it, yeah.
I guess the world is full of cookies, huh?
Here's a Lamington. A Lamington is essentially a cube of sponge cake. And then, on the outside, on all the sides of the cube, you spread some kind of yucky icing, and then you roll the whole thing in desiccated coconut.
Yes, it's all coming to me. But you know, Peter, I don't remember.
Like I said, I hated them.
Well, I don't remember reading a recipe that called for rolling it in yucky icing.
Well, there has to be something on the outside.
I don't think I've ever.
Otherwise, the coconut wouldn't stick. The coconut has to have something to stick to.
I don't remember seeing the word yucky in the recipe.
No, that's my own opinion. Many majority of Australians absolutely adore them.
Now, Dory, let's talk a little bit about you do your little stories with each recipe. You have something about storage, which I think is very important. I was so surprised when you said if you make these bars, you actually store them, not cut, because they'll keep longer.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then what is playing around? That's fun. Your playing around sections are really fun.
Thank you. So I have always, I've always wanted people to build confidence in the kitchen and to have fun in the kitchen. And people follow, and I want everybody to follow recipes, but people follow recipes, and many don't realize that there are small changes that you can make, that you can make a recipe, you can change a recipe so that it will be more to your taste, more the way you want it. And so when a recipe is play-aroundable, I put it in the book. So, for instance, if you wanted to make a cookie with chocolate in it, if you wanted to change the spicing, if you wanted to change the nuts, if you wanted to make slice and bake cookies instead of scoop cookies, there are all kinds of possibilities. And so I add those to get people thinking about how they can make the recipe their own.
Yes, well, it's good because I think more people are getting away from just rigid recipes.
It's fun to play, yeah.
Yes. I was surprised to find a fortune cookie in this book.
You know, I always wanted to make a fortune cookie, mostly because I always wanted to be in charge of other people's fortunes. And it's so much fun. You know, it's a fussy cookie. You have to play with it. And you know, you're folding the cookie while it's hot. But I got such a kick out of making them. It was just so, but I'm always like this. You know, if I make something for the first time, I'm like a little kid. Look what I made. Look what I made. And I was really excited about the fortune cookies. And we had so much fun filling them and giving, you know, filling them out with fortunes and giving them to people. It was really fun.
What are some of the fortunes you used?
Well, I gave a single friend of mine, of course, the one that said, you know, you will meet a tall, dark, handsome stranger. You know, soon. My favorite one is Hug the Baker.
Yeah, that was good,
Yes, that's my favorite one. I tried to, you know, to make ones that would fit the friends that I was sharing my cookies with. But, you know, fortune cookies are great for a party.
And, I just understood. I never thought of puff pastry cookies, except I've always loved elephant ears and pommier. But you have a section on that. You have a section that people might not expect on savory cookies.
Yes. So when Joshua and I had Burn Cell, I had this idea to do what we called cocktail cookies. And I just discovered, A, that I love them, B, that lots of other people do.
Me too.
C, it's such an opportunity to use ingredients that you might not normally use and to really have fun mixing things. So there's a cookie in the book that somebody said, oh, do you have a cookie for beer? And I said, no. And then I came up with a cookie that has pretzels, cheese, and Old Spice, Old Bay seasoning in the cookie. And it's great with beer. And there are Parmesan cookies that are terrific with sparkling wine. There's a chocolate and cayenne shortbread cookie, a really crumbly, beautiful texture shortbread cookie that's fabulous with red wine. So that was a really interesting chapter for me to work on. I love doing it. And I think it's really fun when you have friends in before dinner and you're having a glass of wine or you're having sparkling wine, in addition to the olives and the nuts and the little cheese pieces and whatever else you might serve. It's so nice to have these savory cookies. And there are a few that you might call crackers, but they really are more cookie than cracker.
What is this with the bees sneeze nuggets and some other
That's probably I had so much fun doing this. So I was at a cocktail bar in New York with a friend, and we're looking, and I only drink wine, I don't drink cocktails, but I, you know, wanted to look at the menu, and there was the bee's knees.
Yes.
And it said, and it said that the ingredients had pepper and lemon and ginger and honey. And I thought, those are the ingredients that I use to bake. And I looked at it again and I thought, I could turn this into a cookie. I know I can. And so I did. And I included the gin as well.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yep. So, and the cookie is wonderful. And when we were, it's really funny because when we were doing the photography, after we shot the adorable picture of the bee sneeze, we ate, of course, we ate everything that we shot. And I had had some pumpkin cut to serve with lunch. And Davide Luciano, the photographer, grabbed a piece of parm and put it on top of the bee sneeze. And it was delicious together.
Well, so much is delicious and so much is stuff that nobody would ever even think about except you with your creative mind and your fixation on cookies. And what was it that you were curious about, Rabbit? Oh, yes, the breakups.
So this is a kind of cookie that I just wish we did this more often. So I have two cookies that you might call breakups. One is a fairly well-known cookie, the Torta Spritzolana. So it's a cookie with big hunks of almond in it, and it has cornmeal and flour. And you bake it in a square baking dish. And you can either cut it into squares if you want, or you can put it out on the table and let everybody break pieces apart.
What a great idea.
I love that. And then because I love that so much, I created something called the Pecan Brown Sugar Crack-Ups.
Yeah.
And they are pecans and flour and brown sugar. They're so salt. They're really, really good. And again, it's a cookie that you bake in a pan and then just let everybody go at it. And I think it's the kind of sweet that kind of keeps the conversation going, keeps people at the table. It's very friendly. It's the kind of cookie that puts people at ease because you're just breaking off a piece and nibbling, going back and breaking off more. It's a very congenial, convivial kind of cookie. And I love eating like that.
Yeah, I do too. I see it. Well, Dory, you've created not just a cookie cookbook, but you've created an entire world of cookies.
Thank you, Anne.
Stamped with your lovely, charming personality. So I just think this is it's a game-changer book, I think.
Oh, thank you so much. That means the world to me. Thank you.
And thank you so much for joining us today.
Dory Greenspan's Dory's
on the menu and listening to stories about Tate and Lyle's golden syrup and other things like that. We all have a little something we can learn from each other every day.
Thank you, Dory. True. Thank you both.
Did you catch Dory's answer to one of our questions, listeners? These are all new recipes, right? She wasn't going into her magic book of cookies baked over the years. She created all new ones.
She loves doing that.
She does indeed, yeah. And you'll enjoy making them and wolfing them down. I feel sure. And we'll be back after a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. And I have another favorite baker, Kate McDermott. Yeah. And not only that, I'm going to admit to something. My very favorite dessert is, in fact, what Kate applies her talents to, and that's called the art of the pie.
This lady's obsessed with pie, you'll find out.
Yeah, me too.
and if you follow what she's saying in her book, you'll be obsessed with it too.
And we're going to be talking to the, I would say, world famous pie maker. I'm not exaggerating, Kate McDermott. I mean, you're known far and wide, and we've spread the word about your pie camp to all of Peter's relatives in England, too, because they're all just rife with sweet teeth.
They're pie hounds.
They're pie hounds. But you actually, I've thought that you had written a number of books before, but you said this is your first book, and it's confirmed by your publisher, called Art of the Pie, A Practical Guide to Homemade Crusts, Fillings, and Life. And I think that basically that last part is something everybody should take note of, because this book is really you, isn't it?
Well, it is, and I poured my heart and soul into this book. It's a compilation of everything I've learned about pie over many years of teaching and experimenting. And I found that there's many life lessons that I've learned from pie making that I wanted to share with others, too.
Yeah. And
now, you had to be talked into it, though. Be honest. You had to be talked into it.
Well, I did. I was asked, probably starting as early as 2008, if I would write a book. And I, quite frankly, just didn't feel ready. And so as the years went on, 2 years ago, I was asked by my wonderful publisher, the Countryman Press, W.W. Norton, if I would come and talk to them when I was in New York teaching a class. And I said yes, and kind of felt like a big girl walking down Fifth Avenue to their offices. And I had a wonderful meeting there. I worked with a fabulous team. We kind of, I call everyone Team Pie. And,
Team Pie.
Yes. And now 2 years later, there's this incredibly amazing book that is going now out into the world on the Pie Way.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's beautifully photographed as well.
Oh, I think so, too. My photographer, Andrew Scrivani, is, I couldn't have asked for a better photographer. He's he's just a master of light. All the photos in the book were taken with natural light, and I made every single pie that is in that book.
Did he eat them? Because I'm jealous.
I can tell you that there was a 5-day photo shoot in New York in his studio, and then he came to Pie Cottage in Port Angeles, Washington, for 3 more days of the photo shoot, and there was a steady stream of happy faces coming in and out of both his studio and my house, receiving the benefits of all those pies that you see on those pages.
Now, you call your house Pie Cottage. Now,
yes, I do.
Explain that.
Oh, well, it's it just sort of kind of came, kind of happened. I moved to this little house in 1999, and over the years of teaching and writing and blogging, I started collecting pie memorabilia and little things, lots of pie pans. I have 98 pie pans.
Yeah, I read that.
And, I was putting pictures on the walls and, having rolling pin. I have a rolling pin coat rack.
Oh, my.
Just, all sorts of different little things. And it just occurred to me one day that, this was a cottage that was built upon my love of pie and dedicated to pie. And it just seemed like it's Pie Cottage. And it truly is, it's a wonderful place to be. It's a sanctuary for pie.
Now, but you said, or you write in your book, that anybody who wants to could come find their way to your cottage, knock on your door, and you will give them a pie. Now, I thought.
Pretty much.
I thought that's really risking. I mean, how's she ever going to fulfill that promise? Until Peter explained to me how far out in the nowhere that you live.
That's right. I live on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State, directly across from Victoria, British Columbia. And it's a very small town. And, you know, people find their way here. And if there's a pie on my counter, which there are many, usually is, I'm very happy to give a pie or at least a piece of a pie to someone if they knock on the door and I'm here. I've never sold a pie in my life.
Yeah, that I was astounded reading that. You've never sold a pie.
No, but I will give pies, and I teach pies. Other people can sell the pies. I love the teaching. I love the giving, and I love the teaching.
Now, I've been in Port Angeles, Washington, so I know it's far away.
Oh, my goodness, what were you doing here, Peter?
I think what was happening was I was whiling away the hours until I could get the red-eye flight back to Pittsburgh.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. I did a
really large project out there in the center of the state in Pullman, Washington.
Uh-huh.
And my time out there, which was a lot and frequent, I would work the morning, and then I would while away the time until midnight or close to it when the last plane out, the one that arrives the next morning, the red-eye left. So I drove all over the Olympic Peninsula. I drove down to the state capital. I drove up to Port Angeles. I drove all over the place rather than just sitting somewhere and being bored.
So we know where you are. So we know where we can get a pie.
Yeah, right.
Yes, you do. Well, you didn't stop by.
I didn't know you were there. This was,
I'm waiting for you.
This is 25 years ago.
Okay.
Now, you also do pie camps, which I find a really charming idea.
Yeah, I do. I have multi-day pie camps that I hold at Pie Cottage, and also sometimes I hold them at different places in Washington, sometimes in different places of the country. And then I do one-day pie camps. One-day pie workshops, or the pie workshops that I hold also at my house and also at different parts of the country. So pie has really been a great way for me to meet lots and lots of people and help them to overcome this fear that people have of making crust. It really is easy.
Well, see, that's where I can't say I don't trust you, because I think you're talking me into trying it once again, but I am impossibly inept at pie making. And I told you my one major disaster, and you said you had another one for blind baking pies. What were yours?
Well, the first time that I tried blind baking, I read the directions. It said to roll out the dough and crimp the edge, and then to dock the dough, which is pricking it all over with a fork, even on the sides, and I did all that. And then it said, put in the pie weights. So I put in the pie weights. I put in beans. And then when I pulled out the pie from the oven where I was baking it without the filling, I missed one crucial step that was not in the recipe, and that was put a layer of parchment paper or foil between those beans and the crust. So I had to pick out the beans.
Oh,
one
dear.
By one.
would it probably be easier to start over now? Now, just for those like me who are totally green about this. Blind baking is when you bake the crust before you put the filling in, and then you're going to cook it again.
Yes, you would. Well, actually,
no.
You don't cook it again.
No, you
blind
cook it.
Baking
you cook the filling separate.
Yeah. So it's for example, a lemon meringue pie will use a blind baked crust, Peter. So you bake the crust and let it cool completely. Now you have a completely baked carrier for whatever cooked filling then that you will fold into that baked crust.
Okay, and then when do you put the lid on?
Well, on some of these pies, the lid never goes on.
No, because they don't have a lid. I understand that.
On a lemon meringue pie, you'd put the meringue on top of the hot filling, and it sort of seals itself, kind of cooks and seals itself onto the top of that filling. And then you pop it into the oven for 5 or 6 minutes to brown the meringue, or you can take one of those fancy torch things. I don't have one of those. I just have an old oven. And so it'll brown those, those beautiful little meringue curls on top. Or many times, I'll use it with like a pastry cream, and then maybe, just put some fruit, sprinkle some fruit on the top. It's a lovely, easy way to make a dessert.
But if you're making a good old fruit pie, like an apple pie, or a strawberry pie, or a gooseberry pie,
you don't do that.
What do you do?
No. So those, I roll out my dough.
Yep.
I put in a filling, and the filling of a good fruit pie will, really only has four things. It has fruit, sweetener, thickener, and seasoning.
Yeah.
And then I will mix those. I put those into the pie shell that I have rolled out, and it's in my pie pan.
Uh-huh.
And then I will roll out my top dough and place it on top, finish my edges, make a few vents, give it a little egg wash, pop it in the oven and bake it.
And so then you don't blind bake.
No, you don't blind bake.
You don't blind bake.
No.
See,
no,
you could have made it, done it so much quicker, and just said if it's a pie with a lid on, you don't blind bake it.
There is a 1862 article essay written by Henry Ward Beecher called Apple Pie, and in it one of the paragraphs he talks about one of the techniques is that you cook the filling and then you place the lid on top. You place the cooked lid, the baked lid on top after. So, there are, what we do now, what I do is one style of baking. I'm sure, Peter, that there's somebody along the way who's done exactly the way that you're talking about.
There's no right or wrong way. There's only pie. There's only pie, and it's this laid back approach to pie that experts or novices are going to love about this book. I'm going to reference, by the way, Kate's Rules of Pie Making and Life. The first one is keep everything chilled, especially yourself. The second one is keep your boundaries, which a lot of people have trouble doing in all kinds of ways. And the third one is vent, which I love particularly. Back to what I consider
is that what you've been doing recently? You're making a lot of pies?
I'm venting, yes. back to where
you caught, you caught that one sneaky one there, Kate.
The deception. You say it's all easy. Now, if it's so easy, why is it so many people have trouble with crust?
Well, I think that's a question that I get at classes where someone will come in and say, I can't make the pie that my grandmother made or my Aunt Ruth or my Uncle Fred or whoever it is. And can I make that? Or will I be able to make that? And I say, well, maybe, but how about you make your own pie? Because your pie will be your own pie. It'll be, it may not look the same. It may be a different recipe. But it's going to be your pie. And I think if we lose the idea that a pie must look like the ones that we see sometimes on magazine covers or centerfolds of magazines that I look at them certainly and I'm inspired by the beauty of them, but they just feel like, could I ever do that? Maybe, one out of every 100 will look like that for me, and I'm just like, wow, give myself a pat on the back, look what I did. But I think every pie is beautiful, and if we just give it a try, knowing how to patch things, how to fix things, which my book gives you lots of tips about how to do that, we get the biggest joy of all of making a pie and presenting it to someone, of sharing it with someone, whether the pie looks like the cover of the magazine or whether it looks like it's patched together, it is still full of love.
Yeah, the one wonderful thing about this book is it has nothing to do with the recipes. It has to do with the people you cooked pies for, and the people that having Pie Camp allowed you to meet, like our old friend Ruth Reichel.
And our would-be friend,
I think. And have you ever met Julia Child?
Oh, heavens, that was years ago. She was already at James Beard Awards.
I loved the story about the memorial pie, the Julia Child memorial pie, if we can call it that. Why don't you tell the story?
Well, that was such a wonderful and bittersweet day. First off, let me say that I had the very good fortune of going to Santa Barbara, my hometown, when Julia Child was living there in the later years of her life. And I mustered up my courage and called her assistant, Stephanie Hirsch, and said, I'm going to be in Santa Barbara. Could I meet with Julia? And she said, well, yeah, this is great. You know, there was, you know, a few other things going on. And so we met. We had lunch together at a restaurant that actually had belonged to my godfather,
Dwarf,
which was Moby Dick. Yeah, he used to be a restaurateur in Santa Barbara. He's no longer alive, of course, but Moby Dick is still there. And so we had lunch, and then afterwards she asked if I would drive her around to some of her favorite spots in Santa Barbara, which I was,
wonderful.
You know, overjoyed to do. So, you know, then, and she asked me at the end, you know, please come back and visit me, which, you know, I never did. And I always felt really like, why couldn't I have just taken that little bit of extra time somehow and gotten down there again? But life gets busy. So I was here in Port Angeles with another one of her mutual friends visiting, and we heard on the news at a shop that Julia had passed away, and it was just stunning. You know, we were just like stunned, and we came back to the house and that evening made a dinner, set a place at the table for her. There were a number of people that, you know, were there that evening, and you know, toasted her. I learned to make my first lattice crust that day, which was the day of her passing. And I will always remember that of, you know, it was a pie for Julia. It was a pie to celebrate her life and her love and how much she has inspired all of us as home cooks to just do it. You know, she more than anyone who was like, look what she did. She inspired an entire, you know, she continues to inspire generations of people to be in the kitchen.
This is true.
There's every kind of pie known to man in this book, and many that are unknown to most of the population. There are so many wonderful recipes, but I went to the end part because I saw that you claimed that you had a recipe for making English pork pies,
which is his favorite thing.
And this being one of my favorite things, and knowing that in fact, making pork pies is really a fine art, just like the making of fruit pies. And there are contests all over the United Kingdom for the best pie. And one of the shops close to where my mother lived, where she used to order her stand pies for special events, special occasions, they actually placed, I think, first, second, or third in the whole country making a pie. But here's the bit I didn't understand, didn't know, perhaps even doubt, which is how the gravy gets in the pie. because I always thought that the jelly that was in the pie if you ate it cold, or the gravy that came out of the pie if you made it hot with mushy peas or whatever.
Yeah, mushy peas.
that was a byproduct of the cooking of the meat in the pie. And you say something entirely different.
Well, I have to say that I do say something different, and when I actually was in England and learned to make hand-formed, hand-raised pork pies from a master pork pie maker, and how I was taught was that at the end, after the pie comes out of the oven, you have a a bouillon made, stock made, and you with some gelatin in it, and you put that in with a baster into a little hole at the top that you have placed on top of the pie, and you put in this, you pipe in pretty much as this that you can, and then it cools, and that's the jelly, and that's how I learned to do it. So
I'm sure that must be right. It just came as a complete and total surprise to me if you didn't have a pie hole. I used to think a pie hole was a mouth.
Well, it can be.
Well, you took a piece of pie and you stuck it in the pie hole.
I have a question for you.
Go ahead.
I may. So since I know that, you know, pork pies are something that is part of your tradition and you grew up with, and you know what a good pork pie is, how does that recipe look to you, and how does that picture look to you?
Oh, the picture is perfect. If that's a picture of a pork pie you cooked,
that means I can do this, right?
You know how to do it.
Oh, thank you so much.
absolutely, exactly what a good pork pie should look like. There's no question about
it. Great. But you know, let me tell you where I learned. Also, it was Sarah Pettigrew. Who makes pork pies in England.
Yeah.
She came to the School of Artisan Food on the Welbeck Estate in Nottinghamshire. And that's where I learned to make the pies.
Nottinghamshire.
Thank you. Nottinghamshire.
Nottinghamshire. That's where the sheriff of Nottingham came from. And it's not Nottingham either.
Nottingham.
Okay. Thank you.
Kate, this is just such a delightful book, and I mean, I think you did it. Even though I don't really believe you, you talked me into giving it a try. Maybe I should do the pork pie, but I want to do the blueberry.
Please do. And when you're making that pie and you're reading those instructions of how to make dough, and I am on your shoulder, I am talking to you. And I want you to know that I'm there every step of the way with you. And when in doubt, you just say, what would Kate do? And she'd say, oh, don't worry about it. Just do it.
There it is.
We're looking at the pork pie. It looks great. And Kate,
did you ever make one with hard-boiled eggs in the middle?
No.
Well, that's also done.
Yeah, you know what, Otherson, she doesn't have a steak and kidney pie in here.
No, she doesn't. Well,
Not yet.
She doesn't have an Australian meat pie in there either.
Book two.
You'll find out. Yeah, if you need any assistance locating somebody who knows how to make the mystery meat Australian pork pie, we'll get you a contact.
I'd love that. And would you be a taste tester, Peter?
Oh, sure.
Oh, you bet. Absolutely. He's already on a plane. Okay. I hope we run into each other sometime soon. It's just been too long.
And, it has been like good lattice strips, and I hope that our paths will cross.
Oh, great. Okay.
I will
send you a picture of the result of my attempt at making a pie.
Now, for those people who really like to travel for pie, you must have a blog.
I do. My blog is at artofthepie.com/blog, or if you just go to Art of the Pie, you'll see up in the menu bar up there, blog. That's where it is.
Great.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your observations about the subject of pie, which everyone adores, especially those of us around here who get enough of it. We don't get enough of it because the one who will be the cooker of the pies refuses to try. I wonder who that could be.
Yeah, I'm going to try.
Kate.
Thank you, and just be happy and make pie.
Thanks, Kate.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Now, our final segment we probably could entitle, So What's Not to Love About It? But actually, what it is about chocolate. It's the Chocolate Room in New York. And the book is called There's Always Room for Chocolate. And boy, I think if you see these luscious photographs, you're going to agree that you have to make room for your chocolate. Well, there are certain truisms in this world, and here's one, which is also the title of a new book. There's Always Room for Chocolate. This is a book with recipes from Brooklyn's The Chocolate Room, a project of John Payson, who we have on the line, and his wife, Naomi Josepher, is it?
Yeah.
Who will from time to time join us. And you have an interesting backstory. You're all artists, aren't you?
Yes. Well, I moved to New York City to pursue a drumming career, and Naomi moved here around the same time as I did in the early 90s to pursue a modern dance path.
And so how did you end up owning a chocolate cafe?
Well, you know, quite often as being artists in New York City, you do your art and you also work jobs like restaurant jobs where it's flexible and you can go out and play your gigs or dance in your performances. And early on, I wouldn't say we were starving artists, but, you know, New York City living is not cheap.
Right.
And so we wouldn't always go out for dinner. We would quite often kind of try to pop into a place and see later on a Friday or Saturday, hey, do you mind if we just have dessert? and usually if it was late enough, there was no problem with it. So we'd go and just have dessert and coffee or dessert and a glass of wine or maybe throw a cheese plate in there as well. But it was our way of going out and enjoying the town. And, you know, we pursued our respective arts for a while. And then in 2002, we moved from Manhattan, the Upper East Side, out to Brooklyn, to a neighborhood called Park Slope, which is, you know, almost like, it feels like a mountain town to some aspect. It really feels like a small community, although Brooklyn has, you know, 2 million something people. But around that time.
I remember the old Brooklyn. This is a big transformation.
Oh. Yeah, I'm intrigued by the old Brooklyn, and I'm always fascinated to speak with the native Brooklynites who come into the shop quite often. Uh-huh. But you know, it just played out that as my drumming career was at a point of, you know, not being quite where I wanted it to be, we were trying to think of sort of the plan B. And what else could we do in the guise of doing what you love? You know, we knew we loved dessert, and I personally have always loved chocolate. So it was born of, you know, of that love of those things, and then just seeing perhaps an opportunity to create something more than just a local chocolate shop.
Well, it looks very cozy and inviting.
Oh, it absolutely is. We set out to make it nice enough that you would want to come there often, but not so nice that you would only come for like your mom's birthday or something.
Uh-huh. Well, you must have taken a quick study of chocolate because your introduction is all about an introduction to cacao.
Yes. Well, I happened upon a book on the history of cacao early on, and I was fascinated by what it actually is and how it becomes chocolate, you know? And of course, the history of it with the Mayans and cocoa beans being used as currency and all sorts of things, you know, for it to make its way to something that I love to eat really is just a fascinating history of chocolate.
Oh, it is. It's wonderful, yeah.
And
its introduction into Europe, I mean, it's just amazing.
Oh, yes, it's incredible. And we, early on, you know, we were fortunate to meet John Scharfenberger.
He
came in, did a presentation in the shop. We took a trip to the Dominican Republic and went traveled around some of the bigger cacao plantations there. And yeah, it really just came together. I personally went and took a few introductory chocolate confection classes at ICE in Manhattan, but realized, you know, this is going to take a lot more time to perfect than I can devote right now. I'm going to run with this idea. We're going to run with this idea and find people that know what they're doing to sort of help us create our vision.
Well, so you've had a series of chefs, and the last two have been executive pastry chefs at your shop, right?
Yes. We were very fortunate for the better part of 4 years to have Carmen Arroyo, who had previously worked for Union Square Hospitality Group at Tabla. And he came in, and that was sort of the first time that we really went from saying, okay, this person is our head chef, to this person is an executive pastry chef.
Mm-hmm.
And it was then that we, you know, I think we took it up to the next level on what we were going to produce in-house, and, you know, started doing more confections and just, you know, kind of really taking the desserts, you know, up to that next level.
Well, tell me, what you have two shops now, right?
Yes, we have one in Park Slope, Brooklyn, and then there's a lot of neighborhoods, but about 10 minutes away is another neighborhood called Cobble Hill, and we have a location over there.
Yeah. Now, what exactly could someone expect coming into your cafe?
Oh, well, what we set out to do was kind of up the ante on a typical chocolate shop experience. So we wanted to create an actual chocolate experience, one where you could perhaps either come in and buy some chocolates as a gift or buy some chocolate creations for yourself, but also you could maybe sit down and be served dessert and have a glass of red wine with a really good slice of chocolate cake or some house-made ice cream on a brownie sundae. Really sort of classic American, but with certainly some European flair in terms of the quality of the chocolate we use. And really, it's a chocolate dessert cafe or restaurant. So it's to experience it in all of its many forms, or at least have the opportunity to.
But it's all sweets. It's all dessert.
It's all desserts. Yeah, we've toyed with the idea of maybe, you know, doing some sort of quasi-savory brunch, but I don't know. I think for us, you know, it's kind of what makes us unique.
Right. Yeah, no, we just were talking to Dori Greenspan about her new book. And she has a section on cocktail cookies with their savory cookies. The whole book is cookies.
But oh, nice.
Yeah, they're really nice, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly lots, you know, one could do savory with chocolate, you know. With,
oh,
obviously.
Yeah, what about mole?
Oh, of course, mole, yes. Plenty, lots of good mole. But I don't know, you know, we're always open-minded, and perhaps at some point there might be a savory element. I'm not sure.
Now, I mentioned earlier that I really like your graphic presentations. Like, I'm looking at the one on assembling s'mores, and it's very clear how you do it, and you have everything numbered and labeled and all the, you know, exact instructions for getting a s'mores. Tell us about your graphs.
I think what Georgia set out to do with us and with this book was to make it exactly that. Make it very friendly to understanding the recipes, because in my opinion, baking and making confections, it is a science. In so many ways, you know, if you mess up one little thing, the whole recipe can go wrong, you know, and so if a temperature's not correct, you know, you won't get the same rise you're supposed to get, and that could either be the marshmallows not, you know, if it's too hot, they won't come up, or it could be, you know, a cake not rising because something, is not right, and Georgia really, wanted to make this the process well thought out and accessible. And I think, you know, the idea of adding these types of pictures and graphs, that just made sense to her and to us.
How many calories are in the chocolate pecan pie?
Well, you know, we haven't exactly done all of the nutritional analysis, but, you know, people will often come into the shops and ask these types of questions, and I'll say, oh, everything here has no sugar, no fat, and no calories, so just eat your heart out here. But, you know, I don't know the answer to that. But, again, you know, it's about balance, right?
Right.
But life has to have some sweet moments, and life has to have some moments of joy and things that make you smile. And certainly the chocolate pecan pie.
I'm sure.
Well, and then you really should put, you know, a little whipped cream on there, or maybe a scoop of vanilla ice cream. So that doesn't up it too much.
Now, somebody called Fritz Knipschild.
Fritz Knipschild.
He had an interesting last meal. He said he would start with an appetizer of their mint chocolate chip ice cream, followed by a main course of their caramel popcorn, and of course the world famous chocolate cake to finish. Now, why is it world famous? Would Naomi like to explain why is it that people think the chocolate cake is so good? After all, chocolate cake's a chocolate cake.
Oh, well, yes, Naomi, I'll hand it over to Naomi, and she can explain why the Chocolate Room's chocolate cake is world, certainly New York City famous, and I'll go with world famous, but
okay.
Here's Naomi.
Go ahead, Naomi.
Hi. So you're asking about our chocolate layer cake and how it came to be?
Why is it the world's best?
Well, when we opened the Chocolate Room, we decided that if you're going to have a name of the Chocolate Room, you really did have to serve the best. And if we were going to be so bold to serve a chocolate layer cake, that it had to be the best. John is a perfectionist to his credit, and I think a big part of why our success is as it is today, because it had to be just right. So we taste tested every chocolate layer cake in New York City. And I kid you not, at our dining room table in a small little one-bedroom apartment in Park Slope with our next-door neighbor who was finishing up culinary school at the Institute of Culinary Education. And she was our first pastry chef finishing up school. And the three of us went around the city, and we got every layer cake possible. And John looked at us with a straight face after tasting the first couple, and he said, "It doesn't slide off the fork just right." And we looked at him like he was nuts. Like, but in the end, and now having been 11 years in, I understand he has a vision and a palate that is exceptional. And so we went through many different versions of our layer cake before we, you know, opened, and it took us a year to create this cake. And it had to be not too sweet so that you really got the chocolate flavors. It had to be not too dense so that you didn't feel sick when you ate it. It had to be light enough that you would want more. And then we have three different elements. We have the chocolate cake itself, which, you know, had to be what it was. And then we have the frosting, which is a huge part of the cake. And then we have what we call a blackout filling, which is in between each layer. And they're each their own element, and they each had to be just right to create, you know, the exceptional cake that it is. So it was a painstakingly detailed process. And in looking back, you know, I'm grateful for John's perfectionism, because I really do think it brought us to where it is today. And there isn't a day that we walked into the shop, it's the first thing John and I look at. How's the frosting look? It's not quite shiny today, or the cake is too tall, or something's not quite right with that, you know, custard filling. And so we still are sticklers for detail. And I do believe that, in addition to us having a pretty sophisticated taste bud, helped create the cake that it is today. And it has a cult following. It really does. It's
Now, is yours the one that's called Brooklyn Blackout Chocolate Cake, or is that somebody else's? Is that a sort of?
We've never called it a Brooklyn. It's called our chocolate layer cake. I think that's probably somebody else's term. And there's Ebinger's. I think Ebinger's is known for their Brooklyn Blackout cake.
Okay. Now, what makes
was.
It
was?
Yeah, it was. Okay.
Yeah.
But in drink pairing somewhere, didn't I read that you pair that with some kind of Brooklyn Brewery beer?
John's favorite would be chocolate layer cake with a glass of red wine, and Malbec.
Right.
We do a Malbec, and we do a Zinfandel in the store. Other people might love it with a glass of milk or coffee. So we don't judge. I think anything's possible, and we try and provide all sorts of options. We do carry Brooklyn Brewery chocolate stout, and John's adding.
Oh, you do? Okay.
So yeah,
I read that somewhere.
We do, and that would be a phenomenal. I mean, we just made a special tonight. We're doing a s'mores parfait, and we're pairing it with a shake chocolate porter beer, and really? I'm sure it's phenomenal.
Yeah, I'll bet there are some beers.
Oh, boy, does that sound rich.
I bet there are some beers from Dogfish Head that would go well, too.
Yeah. Pairings are like a whole nother fun topic of conversation.
Oh, so sure. You do those, too. Do you and John do those?
We do, and I just gave an interview to somebody else about that who's writing an article, and I think with the pairings, I think we try and demystify it. We certainly pair like flavors with like flavors. For instance, if you have like a nutty, tawny port, we're going to put that with our butterscotch custard or our chocolate almond cake. And if you have more of like a ruby port or a very berry sweet dessert wine, we're going to pair that with our flourless cake that comes with a fresh raspberry Chambord sauce. So I think pairings are beautiful in the sense that you have two flavors and then you put them together and it creates a whole nother experience. And so we are very excited about, the whole pairing notion because it just adds a whole nother element to your experience. So we get excited about our pairings. Mm-hmm. But we'd like to demystify it. I don't think there's a right and a wrong. I think it's sort of, if you like something, then it's great. I don't think it has to be someone telling you what to do. We like to let people know that.
Now, you started out, as John was saying earlier in our conversation, saying it was dessert for dinner.
My favorite comment is if someone comes in and says, do you guys serve food? And I think what they really mean is like a regular savory. And I always say, well, it depends on what you want for dinner. We can give you cake and ice cream for dinner. And some people, that's a very common, do you serve food? And a regular food, I think, well, it depends on what you think regular food is. If some people might think of brownie sundaes regular food. So, it's fun. Yeah.
No, you read my mind because you read my mind because that was the question I was going to ask is what percentage of your customers are actually doing dessert for dinner because it's all they really are interested in.
Yeah, I think most of our customers are coming in to indulge. And fun story is we'll see customers come in at 2:00 in the afternoon to one store, and then at 7:00 at night they'll come to the other shop with this sort of. We call it the look of shame, right? And we keep our mouths shut and we say, and sometimes they'll come in with a spouse or not, and we're not allowed to say anything of how many times we've seen somebody. It's sort of an unspoken rule in the shop. You can't rat on anybody and say how many times you've been in our store in a day, but we definitely have people that come in 2 or 3 times a day sometimes.
Oh, my goodness.
2 or 3 times a day, my goodness.
Yeah. Or at least 3 or 4, if not 3 or 4 times a day, sometimes definitely, 3 times or 4 times a week, which we just have. It's a very communal space. It's a very warm. A customer just came in today and said, how come everybody's so happy here? And I said to her, well, we really love our employees, and we really created a really fun, warm, creative space for people to come work and make some money. And at the same time, I think when we first opened, we were writing our business plan. John said, you can't walk into a chocolate shop and be angry. So we feel like part of our experience is providing a staff that's really warm and friendly and fun and likes to be around people. So that's part of our interview process is finding those special people.
Well, it sounds like you've managed the challenge of doing something that you really enjoy and getting a whole lot of fun out of it in the process.
I think the customers bring great joy to us. It's really, really very rewarding to see people happy. And I think that is one of the reasons John and I opened the Chocolate Room, is we get great joy out of that.
Well, John and Naomi, what a lovely story. And what a beautiful book. And what beautiful desserts.
Oh,
and thank you.
And candy.
We're going to be in Brooklyn fairly soon. I'll probably come around three times and Anne won't
appear
at
all. I won't
say
a thing. Well, we'd love to meet you guys if you're in Brooklyn, and certainly do stop by.
Thank you so much, and keep up the great work.
All right. Thank you for reaching out to us. We appreciate it.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay. Take care.
If it's true that you can gain calories and pounds on your body just by thinking about dessert
or reading a book,
I guess you better purge to remove these things from your system before it's too late. But seriously, what these wonderful ladies, aren't you delighted to have heard from them? Aren't you fascinated to follow in their footsteps? I'd be very surprised if you aren't. And you can follow in our footsteps, same time, same place again next week. So until then,
bye-bye.